Ah, the American consumer. Once again, it all comes down to you. You ready? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 31st day of May. Great to have you along, everybody. From the Marketplace desk of Live by the Sword, Die by the Sword, we take you today inside the mind of the fickle American consumer. Economists and companies and politicians and us spend a whole lot of time trying to figure out what's going on inside those brains, what consumers want, how they feel, and most of all, how they are spending. It drives a huge chunk of this economy, as I think you've heard here a time or two before. And we got some hard data on that this morning. Consumer spending took its biggest jump in 6 years last month, driven in part by big ticket items. Economists were surprised, and maybe you were too, given everything you hear these days about how the headline economic numbers are generally hopeful, but a whole lot of Americans aren't feeling it. So, why the shopping spree last month? Marketplace's Mark Garrison gets us going.
When people are buying new Fords and Frigidaires, that could say something very positive about the economy. It's one thing to feel secure enough to splurge on dinner out, maybe even order that chocolate mousse, but it's a bigger leap to throw down for a new TV or SUV. Former Fed economist Ann Owen is a professor at Hamilton College.
The glass half full interpretation is that people are feeling more confident about the future and they're willing to make big purchases.
More pessimistically, these numbers may just tell us people spent more last month because they held back earlier in the year. So we need more data to get a better sense of how people feel. Measures of consumer confidence and sentiment fluctuate, but overall, they've been on a steady rise in recent years. Now consider this recent poll where nearly 6 in 10 people said the national economy was doing badly. But in the exact same survey, a commanding majority also said their own finances were good. Marjorie Connolly is a senior fellow at the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research, which did the poll. She says it's not nuts to believe both ideas at once.
They may be doing okay, but they haven't seen a raise in a while. They may be doing okay, but if something went wrong and they lost their job, they don't feel comfortable that they would be able to get another job very easily.
There's also this big, noisy thing scrambling people's perceptions of the economy, the presidential election. Michael Strain is an economist at the American Enterprise Institute.
You can't turn on the news without hearing about how terrible the economy is and how we're losing, you know, whatever that means in all of our contests. That's whipping people up and getting people down, and that has to be having an effect on the overall psychology.
Today's spending numbers may well be a sign people are feeling better about their own prospects, but it's just a month of data, so don't get too confident that the shopping spree will continue. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
About 40,000 Verizon workers are going to be back on the job tomorrow, ending a strike that has lasted almost 7 weeks. There will be a pay raise and some new hiring at call centers in particular, 1,400 or so new jobs, according to the company. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more now on how U.S.-based call centers are becoming the new thing.
The call center jobs were a big deal for the unions. Here's Candace Johnson of the Communication Workers of America.
There are probably close to 10,000 call center workers that we represent at Verizon.
But for Verizon, the jobs weren't a deal breaker. Verizon spokesman Rich Young.
It didn't happen. That's fine, and we'll move on.
Instead, the company settled for a concession on changes to the way customer service calls are routed. Besides, according to Moore Armoni at New York University Stern School of Business,
very quietly, companies have been returning call center jobs to the U.S. from where they were outsourced to, whether it was India or the Philippines.
Because all the outsourcing we saw in years past, well, it just looked bad.
There's been a big backlash, but also from a business perspective, there's a basic trade-off between quality and costs.
Plus, new customer service technology is making outsourcing less competitive. Simple jobs that were once cost-effective to outsource are now handled online or through apps. That's according to Vijay Mehrotra at the University of San Francisco.
As more and more of that work gets automated, the pressure on outsourcers to demonstrate competence in higher complexity stuff is going to be where they win or lose.
Verizon says the company's suggested closure of call centers was never about outsourcing. Regardless, if union workers give the okay in June, there will be more of those jobs in the U.S. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the actual last day of trading for the month? Decidedly meh. We'll have the details, when we do the numbers. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, oil producers in this country pumped an average of 8.7 million barrels of oil per day last week. I mentioned that on the way to saying that it was not always thus. It was especially not always thus back in the 1970s, the days of the Arab oil embargoes, the after effects of which we are still coming to grips with today. Meg Jacobs writes about that period in her new book. It's called Panic at the Pump, The Energy Crisis and the Transformation of American Politics. Meg, it's good to have you on.
Nice to be here.
October 1973-ish. Tell me what was happening.
That was the start of the Arab embargo when Arab members of OPEC placed an embargo on the U.S. in response to the U.S. support of Israel in the Yom Kippur War, and that triggered a shortage in the United States, leading to what I call a panic at the pump.
Yeah, it actually was a panic. I mean, people were thinking about rationing. There were new dealers still in Washington saying we have to completely reallocate how we do the economy. I mean, the politico-economic after effects of this thing were and are amazing.
They're hard to imagine today. Richard Nixon, a Republican, was in the White House, but he faced a Democratic Congress, and the default solution to any problem was more government. So amazingly, the response to the shortage and to the rising prices were to put in place government allocations and price controls. And the number one demand, which in effect works out, is to roll back the prices at the pump, something that's unimaginable to us today.
And it's Republicans who are putting this into effect. And they were looking at each other going, are you kidding me that it's us?
Yeah. So you have, for example, the first ever energy czar is William Simon. Mm-hmm. And Richard Nixon puts him into place. And here's this guy who's a conservative who has to make decisions whether the Daytona 500 should go on as planned or it should be the 450.
Which is remarkable. And there was talk and in reality in those years of dark Christmas trees, of thermostats being reset, of the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, oh, by the way.
Which Americans hated more than anything else. To them, this really symbolized the end of the America that they knew. The car, which had been the symbol of American success and greatness and prosperity, now became a symbol of its decline. Not only did they have to drive slower on the roads, but they had to wait in mile-long lines, sometimes waiting so long that they even ran out while online.
There's a great quote in this book. If Vietnam and Watergate taught us that our government lied, the energy crisis taught us that our government didn't work. It was ineffectual, basically.
That was especially true during the second oil shock in the summer of 1979, when Americans found themselves lining up once again. And this was particularly horrifying because Jimmy Carter, who was president, a Democrat, had promised to solve the energy crisis. And here Americans were having this repeat experience. And it really did trigger this loss of faith in government. So there were bumper stickers saying, Carter, kiss my gas, and even more extreme outpourings of unrest. So, in fact, in Levittown, Pennsylvania, there was a full-on gas riot where local citizens put set cars on fire, chanting more gas, more gas.
And there were economic repercussions, too, from this whole period, right? I mean, inflation, which brought us Paul Volcker. There was fear of and talk of deficits. I mean, things happened economically because of what happened in October 1973.
Yeah. I mean, the whole decade became defined by inflation, and the energy crisis seemed the most salient, visible outcome. You could sort of see how prices were going up daily by the price placards at your local gas station. It used to be the case that there were not enough digits on the gas station pumps so that they actually, when the gas prices went above a dollar, they had to start pricing at the half gallon.
We now are a huge oil and energy producer. The Saudis are looking to get out of the oil business, for crying out loud. Help me make sense of that.
Yeah, I mean, our situation seems like we've finally solved this problem of energy dependence, if you define dependence as dependence on imports from abroad, and that's largely thanks to the fracking revolution. But we've also, history has also shown us that the oil market is volatile over time and unpredictable over time. And so while it seems that there's been a revolution in production in this country, you're never quite sure what the future is going to bring.
Panic at the Pump by Meg Jacobs, who teaches at Princeton. Meg, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up.
States have used the broadness of these four purposes to justify all kinds of spending that you might not associate with welfare or work.
The end of welfare as we know it 20 years on. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is down 86 points today, about a half percent, 17,787. The NASDAQ, though, up 14 points, more than a quarter percent, finished at 49.48. The S&P 500 shaved 2 points off, a tenth percent, 2,096 as well. As we mentioned, the latest consumer spending figures say we're buying stuff, expensive stuff like cars. Ford Motor Company revved up nearly 0.3%. General Motors climbed a third percent. Fiat Chrysler gained 0.3%. Companies that sell other kinds of big-ticket items like home appliances and electronics, here's where the meh comes in. Sears unplugged 0.3%. Whirlpool stuck in the spin cycle unchanged. Best Buy up 0.4%. Today, we checked in on Verizon and details about its deal with striking workers. Verizon secured a 0.5% gain today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We talked about the 1970s and the oil industry earlier. Here is a current day story. We talk not infrequently about the fallout in the oil patch from the collapse in crude prices. Less often mentioned is the rest of the petroleum product chain. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim is on that one.
Crude oil, natural gas, those are just the first things you get from extraction. Refine the products, crack them, you get new materials. Eventually, you get plastics like polypropylene and polyethylene. In the form of pellets, those raw plastics are easily transportable and higher in value. You can really increase your margins if you've got a lot of source materials to work with. That's how the Middle East became a big plastics producer. Production in the U.S. had been stalled, but then the shale drilling. Nick Vafiatis is a business director at IHS Chemical.
And it was only when shale gas came into the picture and these U.S. producers had access to low-cost feedstocks and the ability to be very competitive and profitable that they decided to expand the industry again.
Several new petrochemical plants are being developed, especially around Houston and Louisiana. The U.S. is a contender.
The fact is, when we look at the market today, we see capacity growing at about 7.8 million metric tons more than demand during the 2016 through 2018 timeframe.
Add to that the Middle Eastern industry and a growing one in China, and we've got a plastic glut. Dominic Russo is director of trading at the Plastics Exchange.
It's going to become very competitive. Prices are going to decrease. There's going to be lots of material available. And we should, you know, in the long term, see resin prices drift lower.
Which could mean slightly lower prices on consumer goods until about 2019. After that, global demand is expected to catch up. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Twenty years ago this summer, this coming August, actually, Congress passed and President Clinton signed the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1996, otherwise known as welfare reform, politically known at the time and since as the end of welfare as we know it. Our Wealth and Poverty Desk is devoting the first season of our newest podcast, The Uncertain Hour, it's called, to welfare reform, specifically what 20 years of it has meant. Because the new law came with some specifics, work requirements, time limits on cash assistance, and yearly block grants to the states to fund the whole thing. Among the most basic of questions then, 20 years on, is how states are spending that money. From our Wealth and Poverty Desk, here's Marketplace's Chrissy Clark.
All right, so we're going to talk about love style. house.
It's a Thursday night in Oklahoma City, and I'm in a crowded conference room.
Love styles, right?
At the front, there's a guy with a white goatee and a polo shirt.
Let me ask you something.
His name is Scott Roby, and he's pointing at a slide with the image of a big, colorful heart on it. The heart's divided up into different quadrants, labeled with different love styles.
There's do, be, give, encourage, talk, and touch. Those are the six different dimensions or love styles. And we all have all of these within us.
But Scott says in every person, one or two love styles really rise to the top. Like if you're a doer, actions are an expression of love.
Maybe cooking a meal, doing a chore of theirs that they typically do, doing a load of laundry. Oh, I said the L word, but yeah. You know, something like that.
The audience is leaning in now. People are nudging each other, giving knowing looks when their love style comes up.
Sensual touch, if it's really going to feed the love style and feed the relationship, it's not always about landing the plane, if you know what I mean. Right?
Scott's audience, mostly young or middle-aged professionals, are dressed in their business casual clothes, most headed to this room right after work. And everyone in here is either married or engaged. In fact, that's the whole reason why they're here. It's a free class called Forever for Real.
Go make your forever for real.
Open to any couple who lives in Oklahoma, a kind of marriage counseling 101 to help them improve their relationships and build strong marriages. And dance to a little Al Green. Draw pictures of what a modern marriage looks like.
We're drawing a bicycle to show all the different phases of a relationship.
At the break, over Chex Mix and pizza, I mingle with some of the couples.
I'm Trey Martin.
Trey works in biotech. His fiancée,
Lori Radford,
is a paralegal. They met online. They're getting married in April. Heard about this class at a bridal show. And as they've just discovered, they're quite compatible when it comes to love languages. Thank goodness.
Touch.
Bingo. Touch.
Well, that's nice to have the same language. Okay, so I should probably tell you what I'm doing here in this marriage class. I am actually newly married myself, and I think touch is probably one of my preferred love styles, too. Also, encouragement. But I was at this Forever for Real class in Oklahoma City for a different reason, to ask couples like Trey and Lori two questions. Okay, a question that is going to sound like it's out of left field, but there's a reason I'm asking it. How do you feel about government assistance and welfare in this country? Do we spend enough, too much, not enough? Lori did not skip a beat.
I think too much.
And you feel like too much, why?
Because I think that the people who receive it, a lot of those people don't try to go find jobs. A lot of them just sit at home and they're not looking to better themselves.
And then I ask the second question. What if I told you that this class is funded by the welfare program? Trey and Lori look at each other and this kind of amused panic spreads over Trey's face.
Oh my God, we're on welfare. I never thought I'd be on welfare. Well, that's great.
Oklahoma is just one of many states across the country where, 20 years after welfare reform, tens of millions of welfare dollars are going to things that surprise even the people who are benefiting from them. And not just those people. Even policy wonks like Devon Douglas of the Oklahoma Policy Institute are surprised by how her state spends welfare money, or as it's officially known, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, TANF.
When I bring this up, you know, in conversation with my friends, when I can't stop nerding out about my job, you know, there's kind of a quizzical look on their face and they think, oh, is the government like doing a matchmaking service? Like, does TANF help Tinder? Like, how does this work exactly? People just don't think that TANF is about getting people married.
But for others in Oklahoma, this makes perfect sense.
At the most basic level, a two-income family is more likely to take people out of poverty than a one-income family.
Mary Myrick is the president of Public Strategies, the for-profit public relations firm that runs Oklahoma's marriage initiative. Since 2001, her company has received more than $70 million in welfare money to run these marriage classes. The whole idea took hold in Oklahoma in the late 90s, when a report was commissioned by the state to look at why Oklahoma had one of the lowest per capita incomes in the country. The report pointed to the state's high divorce and out-of-wedlock pregnancy rates as possible causes. Right around the same time, welfare reform was kicking in, and the new system of block grants that gave states a lot of flexibility in terms of how they could use federal welfare dollars. Here's Kendi Cox, who also works at Public Strategies.
And so our governor at the time met with our Department of Human Services and said, why don't we use a very small portion of that money to try some innovative things to strengthen families as a way to say, you know, we spend in government so much time, so many resources dealing with the fallout of the family. Perhaps we should do some things on the prevention side.
And the Oklahoma Marriage Initiative was born. Some classes target low-income people, but most are open to everyone, rich, poor, and in between.
We're also providing an opportunity for anybody in the state of Oklahoma to access services that really can bolster not only their relationship, but their ability to stay self-sufficient and avoid poverty if they are, you know, middle-income people.
But the fact that all of these programs are funded by welfare dollars has become a growing concern to state lawmakers in Oklahoma, Democrats and Republicans, because while the money's going to lots of families who don't consider themselves especially needy, the state is also full of families who are, by any measure, very needy, but aren't getting any cash welfare at all. In Oklahoma, just 7 out of every 100 families living in poverty receive cash assistance.
We've got Chrissy Clark in the studio with us for some more on that story. Hey, Chrissy.
Hey, Kai.
So about that last paragraph, just 7 out of every 100 poor families in the state of Oklahoma get cash assistance. How did that happen? How did they get there?
Yeah. So part of the reason so many fewer poor families get cash welfare in Oklahoma compared to before welfare reform is because the state has really shifted a lot of its spending away from cash welfare. Today, Oklahoma spends just about 9% of its so-called temporary assistance for needy family dollars on cash assistance. Meanwhile, almost as much, 5%, goes to promoting marriage and preventing out-of-wedlock pregnancy. And that's completely legal because the way the welfare reform law was written in 1996, it was pretty vague. There's this preamble at the beginning that lists these four purposes of the law. And at the time, they didn't get a whole lot of attention. But it turns out that these four purposes, these bullet points, are actually what ends up controlling how states can spend their welfare money. And the first two boil down to what you might think of as welfare, cash assistance, help getting welfare recipients to work, things like job training and child care and transportation. I actually have all four of them printed out for you here.
Okay, here we
so
go.
Take a look at numbers 3 and 4.
All right. Numbers 3 and 4. Prevent and reduce the incidence of out-of-wedlock pregnancies. Fine. Encourage the formation and maintenance of two-parent families is number 4. And I guess you could see that, right? I mean, and that's what some of the women in that piece were talking about. Two-income family helps that whole family stay out of poverty.
Right. But, of course, this is not what we heard a whole lot of coming out of welfare reform and the headlines. And even many of the folks who supported this focus on marriage 20 years ago say that the programs that have come out of the push haven't done a whole lot to reduce poverty yet. It's just too complicated a set of dynamics and trying to encourage people to get married. But beyond that, states have used the broadness of these four purposes to justify all kinds of spending that you might not associate with welfare or work. Nationally, just about 1/4 of all temporary assistance for needy families dollars goes to cash assistance. 1/4 goes to work supports, things like job training and childcare, and the other 1/2 goes to other things. Things like foster care, pre-K programs, marriage promotion programs. And regardless of how worthy these programs might be, meanwhile, many of the very poor are not getting any just basic assistance. Nationally, just 23 out of every 100 poor families with children gets cash assistance today.
You have, as part of this project, created a tool that we're going to have on our website, right, where people can go and look and see what their states spend on welfare, and how many poor families with children get that cash assistance?
Yeah, right? It's pretty amazing to dive into what your state does.
We have it, obviously, on our website, the new podcast from a Wealth and Poverty Desk. It's season one, episode, what, three is the new one, right?
Three, yeah.
Three. It's called The Uncertain Hour, available, obviously, wherever you get your podcast. Check it out. It's quite a piece of work, as always, from Chrissy Clark and the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Thanks, Chrissy.
Thanks so much, Kai.
Final note on the way out today. You know how conventional wisdom and the government of the United States has it that North Korea was behind the huge hack of Sony Pictures about a year and a half ago? A pause here for reconsideration of Pyongyang's technical prowess, if I might. There were reports last week that North Korea had set up a Facebook clone, necessary because, of course, the genuine article is banned there. It turns out, though, that a college student from Scotland was able to hack it pretty much like that. Because the administrator's password, yeah, was password. Don't do that, okay? Hi, Kai Rizdahl here. Thanks for listening to this Marketplace podcast. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. So here's some context on us. We're a nonprofit service, and we rely on donations from our listeners to keep on going. And we've just made special Let's Do the Numbers Pilsner glasses available to thank you for your support. So please donate today at marketplace.org. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 86 points today, about a half percent. The NASDAQ up, though, 14 points, about a quarter percent. The S&P 500 down 2 points, about a tenth percent. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwadonatam and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.